You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
My name is George Perkovich. I'm a vice president for studies here at the Carnegie Endowment. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to this presentation led by John Echeverry Gent of an American Political Science Association task force on inequality, difference, and the challenge of development. And they're going to be presenting the report of the task force. It's a double pleasure for me. I'm very interested in the subject of inequality and, in particular, international injustice. But as importantly, or as a more important cause of this event being here, is that John, 11 years ago, showed up at my dissertation defense at UVA and was very kind, a kind presence in the room. I had not studied with him. I worked on something, a different topic, nuclear weapons in India, but it was great to have him there, and I appreciated his presence. And so when he'd mentioned that they had done this report, I was eager to provide a Washington venue for its release. And so John is going to present the core findings of the report in about 20 minutes. He's a professor at UVA, but he's working now on a book that I think will be very interesting. The working title is Politics of Markets, the Political Economy of Reforming India's Stock Markets. And I think given the role and prominence of the Indian stock market both within India and in kind of international imagination about India, it'll be very interesting to understand more of how that's worked. John's going to talk first, and then Gerard Alexander, who's also a UVA professor but who's a visiting scholar this year at the American Enterprise Institute, is going to offer his comments, and I think based on your publications, Gerard, the book, The Sources of Democratic Consolidation, my sense is that you have a sense of kind of how these issues of inequality and difference then play out through political processes and stability and instability in states, which is, after all, one of the big things I think that motivates the wealthier countries to actually be concerned about this issue. There may be a dose of altruism there, but generally it is. They want stability, and so there's a very interesting analytic problem there. I would just say briefly, I mean, one of the reasons why I was so eager to host the report is that inequality in particular, I think, is a very hard subject to talk about, especially in the United States. We have a peculiar ideology that maybe's always been there, but in the last three or four decades has been very strong, where it's just not something that's done in political circles. That we have a certain system that works, and if it produces inequality, that's kind of the stuff that's better to kind of keep hidden and not talk about. And then that starts extending internationally. And while it's hard to talk about, I think it's even harder for governments to do something about. And that's one of the reasons I think people don't want to talk about it. There's no sense of what you do about it, and therefore don't talk about it, because otherwise it's kind of an admission of failure. But what I like about this report is that if we are going to, as I think we should, talk about it and then try to figure out what can be done about it, the first task is really to understand the causes and dynamics around inequality and difference, and also the experiences of polities and others that have tried to do things about it. And it requires a deep understanding. And I think what's impressive about this report is that you get a textured kind of analysis of the related phenomena there. And so I welcome that. And at that, I'm just going to get out of the way and turn it over to John.
Okay. Thank you, George. Let me say that, as you've seen, George Perkovich is a wonderfully gracious host, and I'm very grateful for him to hosting this event. The reason I attended George's dissertation hearing some 11, 12 years ago is because, in my mind, it was an important intellectual event. And I have ever since then admired not only George's managerial skills, but also his scholarship. So I'm delighted that he agreed to host this event. I also want to thank Gerard Alexander, who on all too short notice agreed to serve as a discussant. I've actually been a colleague of Gerard's at the University of Virginia, and during that time I've really learned to admire his analytical abilities and his distinctive insights. Gerard and I oftentimes disagree on matters, but I feel like I always come away better informed from the engagement I've had with him. And then finally, I very much would like to thank Bahram Rajai and the staff at the American Political Science Association office. Bahram, if you'd stand up. Bahram really did yeoman's work in terms of helping to organize this event, and I'm always indebted to him. So thanks, Bahram. I'd like to just begin by placing this report in the context of developments at the American Political Science Association. This is, in fact, not the first or only task force report. Some years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, the American Political Science Association decided that it really should try to expand the public presence of political science by demonstrating the relevance and insights of political science research and knowledge with regard to critical public issues that have public policy implications. And from that concern and motivation came the idea that the American Political Science Association should sponsor these task force. And this is, as I say, one of a series of task force reports that are designed to report on issues that demonstrate the relevance of political science knowledge to sort of a broad public. I should say that there have been previous task force reports on civic engagement and education, and on inequality and American democracy. I'm really excited and very much look forward to forthcoming reports on political violence and terrorism, on religion and democracy in the United States. So these are clearly very timely topics, and I think they should be very exciting reports. All right. Now, what I'd like to do is to turn to my report. And in my talk today, it won't be possible to cover all aspects of the report. But what I'd like to do is really answer three questions. All right. The first question is, what do we know about inequality in the world today? Right, and in this, I'll give a somewhat historical perspective, and I'll talk about sort of the complex dimensions of inequality. The second question I'd like to address is, why should we be concerned at all about inequality? That is, why is it an important issue for us today? Not everybody appreciates it, and as George said, inequality is oftentimes a complex phenomenon that's very difficult to measure. And then thirdly, I'll have some brief remarks about how we can overcome what I've called the persistent problem of inequality. Okay? So without further ado, then, let me turn to the question of what do we know about inequality in the world today? Right. I put up this chart here, and it's a historic chart, and as historic economic statistics go, it's somewhat rough. But if you look, you can see on the that there are three lines here. The red line is the aggregate of the overall index of inequality. That's an interpersonal measure of inequality amongst all the different peoples of the world. It's broken down into two other indices. The blue index is inequality within countries, and you'll see the green line is inequality amongst countries, between different countries. And together, they add up to the red index of overall global inequality. And one of the things you can see from here is that inequality, if you look at the right-hand side, is at historic high levels. Inequality today is at a level that is, from historical perspectives, very high. Now, I should say that there actually is a considerable controversy over whether since 1980 inequality has increased or declined. It's a very complex technical controversy. I deal with it a little bit. We deal with it a little bit in terms of the report. But for now, let me say that regardless of whether you think inequality has declined since 1980 or whether you think it's stayed the same or increased, those who argue that it has declined still would agree that it is at historically high levels. Right? Now, I said in my introductory comments that inequality is a complex phenomenon, and as such, it can actually be measured in different ways. This is one way of measuring inequality. It's an overall aggregate index. One of the interesting things about it is that to the extent there is a decline since 1980, that decline is almost entirely explained by the rise of China. So China represents about one out of every six people in the world, and its tremendous economic growth is enough to sort of move the overall index as China has moved from a very poor country to more of a middle-income country. All right. But as I say, there are other measures of inequality, and I want to point to a couple of others. One here is this measurement of international income polarization that you see. And here you see that the ratio of the per capita income of people in the poorest country to people in the wealthiest country has actually increased quite substantially. In 1960, the ratio was 35 to 1. That is, people in the wealthiest country had a per capita income of 35 times greater than in the poorest country. In 1990, the ratio moved to be 45 to 1. And then more recently, in 2005, it's increased to 63 to 1. Right. So in terms of this, what we could call absolute inequality or differences in terms of income between people of the wealthiest and poorest country, there's been a steady and quite substantial increase. If we turn and we look at the net wealth per adult in different countries, we see also that there actually the differences are even greater. We don't have historical information about this, but we do have information for the year 2000. And this is, I think, the most authoritative information we have. And I'd just like to note that the average net wealth of adults living in the 24 OECD countries was more than 78 times greater than the average wealth of adults living in 64 less developed countries. So in terms of wealth, the disparities are even greater. Now, let me just say one thing, that we have to take matters into context here. I'm talking largely about inequality in wealth income, and I've sort of made an argument that they are at historic high levels and that according to some indices that they've increased. I think it's important to place matters into context because at the same time that economic inequality has, according to these measures, increased, we have seen a decline in other measures of inequality. So, for instance, data in terms of health, evidence of health welfare have actually, inequality has actually declined, and also in terms of educational inequality, developing countries have made great strides, and that inequality in terms of education has also declined. So some of the problems I'm going to talk about are, I think, serious problems stemming from educational inequality. I would argue that these problems would be even worse if these other dimensions of inequality hadn't improved. Okay. Now, let me then turn to the next question, which is why should we be concerned about inequality at all? Why shouldn't we simply, as many economists would argue, allow just be focused on growth and allow the rising tide that is generated by economic growth lift all boats? And so that why really shouldn't that be our focus? And I think the answer is one that people who work in the area of political science and especially political economy, some actually also economists have jumped on board here, is that inequality plays a very important role in the political and economic development of countries. And in particular, if you look at this chart here, one of the things that you see is that, the argument anyway, is that high economic inequality creates unequal voice in decision-making. And that leads to patterns of institutional persistence and change that produce really socially suboptimal outcomes. That is high economic inequality, as well as inequality in terms of social statuses. So oftentimes we see in developing societies different ethnic groups, and oftentimes we'll see one ethnic group get the upper hand over other ethnic groups, to the extent to which there is status inequality too. In both cases, inequality oftentimes allows elite groups to resist changes that might be in the broader welfare of the society, but which in one way or another threaten to undercut their privileged position. Right, and we see this all too often happen. Now, this is not to say that unequal societies can't experience economic growth, and this is not an argument against the expansion of economic markets. Rather, this is an argument that says that the expansion of economic markets and the benefits of growth are oftentimes limited by the impact of inequality, and that impact works through the political process. Okay? All right. Now, I want to then talk about the impact of inequality at both the international level and then at the sort of domestic level within developing societies. And I'll have some brief remarks about, first of all, at the international level, international trade. Then I'll talk a little bit about international finance before I turn to the domestic scene. Okay. Even in an institution like the WTO, which has formally equal representation, wealthy countries oftentimes use the threat of to exclude less powerful countries with small markets, to exclude them from their large markets as a threat and power resource to shape the development of global markets in their favor. So we can see here on this chart, for instance, on the average, the United States has imposed tariffs on imports from developing countries, which are more than three times higher than the tariffs that they impose on imports from developed countries. Right. If you look at the chart, you can also see that American tariffs for the poorest of developing countries were more than 10 times higher than their tariffs on other OECD countries. So this is a curious bias, because if you think tariffs are to protect from competition, you would think that the sort of least potent competitors would be from the poorest countries. But in fact, you get this anomaly of the highest tariffs of the United States, and this holds true for the European Union as well, are actually against the poorest countries. And this can only have a political explanation from my mind. Another problem that you have is that of tariff escalation. Tariff escalation impedes poor countries from diversifying and entering into more value-added exports by, in fact, having higher tariffs on more advanced products. So as opposed to, let's say, imposing, as the EU does, a tariff on cocoa beans that is only 1%, its tariff on processed chocolate, that is, a product developed from cocoa beans, is actually 30%. All right? So this clearly works in a way that impedes the development of developing countries. I probably need to say very little about the way in which rich countries protect, in fact, their agriculture. But let me just say this, that the overall an overall index for trade restrictiveness for agriculture for the OECD is 25% for agriculture, and it's only 4% for manufacturing. For the United States is a little bit less biased, but its overall trade restrictive index is 12% for agriculture and only 4% for manufacturing. So we have much greater protection for our agricultural sector than we do for manufacturing sector. And one of the reasons for that is that those agricultural countries, especially the developing countries, have less political clout and therefore are less able to drive down tariffs in countries. And then you add to that the agricultural subsidies, which if you follow the legislation in Washington, Washington are quite substantial and have recently been renewed. OECD agricultural subsidies were $280 billion in 2004 and accounted for the same percentage of incomes as it did in 1995, that is 30% of agricultural incomes. Agricultural subsidies in rich countries exceed the entire GDP of sub-Saharan Africa. And they're approximately six times more than all foreign aid from rich countries. So this is a huge amount of money and a huge subsidy given to agriculture. Okay, let me move and talk about global finance. And here, I really am going to skirt what is a much more complicated issue, but I just want to make a couple of points here. One is that if you look at this chart, one of the things you see is that the experience of financial crises has actually increased quite substantially in the most recent period from 1973 to 1997. In the period from 1880 to 1913, what's known as the first era of globalization, it was only 5%. It's gone up to 12%. There are a number of reasons for that, and one is that the global markets are much more integrated, and global markets tend to be more volatile as markets go. We also note the importance of short-term debt, of herding mentality amongst traders due to sort of lack of information, of momentum trading, and also of financial derivatives is creating greater volatility in global financial markets. But one of the interesting things is that this volatility affects developing countries more than it does developed countries. Developing countries were twice as likely to suffer from financial crises during this latter period than were developed countries, averaging a crisis per country once every 5.4 years. Well, why is that? Why is there a differential? And this is a complex matter. I just want to point out one factor. That is that global financial markets effectively transfer exchange rate risk from rich countries to poor countries by requiring them to borrow in what are known as hard currencies. All right. So from 1999 to 2001, for instance, less than 1% of international debt for the United States, the UK, and Japan in euro currency countries were denominated in foreign currencies, whereas 93% of all developing country debt was in foreign currencies. All right. Now, recently, actually, there's been a decline in this incidence of crisis, and that decline is a consequence of a tremendous accumulation of foreign exchange reserves by developing countries. One reason for this is the tremendous economic ascent of countries like China, which now holds more foreign currency reserves than any other country in the world. But another reason is that developing countries have had to follow a strategy of accumulating foreign reserves to insulate themselves from global financial instability. And this has real costs because their reserves are held in investments that have very low yield. They could, in fact, achieve a much higher rate of benefit if they were to invest in their own development rather than holding them as reserves. Okay, let me turn now to the issue of inequality within developing countries. And one of the things you see is that in the past 40 years, there's been an increase in domestic inequality in actually most all countries in the world. A survey of 73 countries found that inequality increased in almost two-thirds of those countries, while it declined in only one out of eight of those countries. If we think about this in terms of population, 59% of the people in these countries, these 73 countries, experience growing inequality, while only 5%, you can see here, experience declining inequality. All right. So this is a generalized trend. It's not, I mean, we look out at the United States and we see growing inequality. That's one of the reasons there was an earlier task force on inequality in American democracy. But it's especially prevalent in developing countries. Actually, the trend poses a puzzle because at the same time that inequality has increased in developing countries, we've also seen the spread of democracy in developing countries, so that the number of democratic countries in the world grew from 39 in 1974 to 122 in 2005. And that raises the question, why hasn't the spread of political equality under democracy reduced economic equality in reduced economic inequality in developing countries? Now, there are a number of reasons for this. One of the very important one is technological change. And all countries are experiencing this. For the purposes of this talk, I just want to highlight a little bit the political dimension of the process here. And one of the things, looking at political science literature, we find is that economic reform in developing countries in the 1980s and 1990s involved liberalizing economic policy. This meant rolling back government interventions. Sometimes it meant reducing government spending on social welfare. Sometimes it meant privatization, which oftentimes worked to the benefit of the large businesses who had the resources to purchase state-owned enterprises. In most countries, I should say in almost all countries, it meant reducing government employment, and in particular, government employment that was used for political patronage. Right. At the same time, we see during the 1980s and the 1990s a new strategy, you might almost say a new technology of political mobilization. A strategy of political mobilization, which very much like the United States, indeed many campaign advisors traveled from the United States to developing countries. It was a strategy based on using the electronic media, in particular television commercials, to make more personalistic appeals. In Latin America, we call the process sort of more neo-populist political mobilization, right? One of the things we notice is that economic liberalization, to some extent, particularly through forms of privatization, oftentimes benefited sort of large businesses to make an effective use of electronic media. Politicians no longer, in fact, needed patronage organizations, but what they did need were financial contributions to finance their electronic appeals. And so this is a political process which we feel very much reflects and reinforces a tendency towards greater economic inequality. All right. Now, I want to talk briefly about two consequences of economic inequality, social economic consequences, before I turn to resolving the problem. The two consequences I want to talk about are, first of all, that economic inequality and the consequent sort of power asymmetries, in fact, tend to accumulate. That is, there are various different forms of inequality, and they tend to accumulate. So those people who suffer from cumulative or multiple inequality oftentimes suffer the most and are left behind in terms of economic development. Let me just give you an example. When we talk about various forms of inequality, I'm talking about inequality in terms of economics, but also inequality in terms of gender, inequality in terms of status or ethnicity, inequality in terms of space. Just let me give you an example of the women, minorities, and indigenous people that are oftentimes left behind. I'll just throw out a few facts. In Mexico, indigenous Mexicans have an 81% poverty rate compared to an 18% poverty rate for the rest of Mexican society. In India, women and female children in India's poorest state of Bihar are not only the least educated, in some of the most backward districts, female literacy rates are 3%, but they're also the most malnourished. Another example is in terms of property rights regimes. Property rights regimes often discriminate against poor women, even in societies like sub-Saharan Africa, where agricultural production depends directly on women's labor. The second consequence of inequality is something that I think is really underappreciated, and it's something that I'd like to highlight. In the last few years, economic development has resulted in growing economic and physical insecurity. All right, this is a insecurity is something that economists really, I don't feel, have adequately developed measures of so that we can have a nuanced understanding of what exactly we mean and what the changes are in terms of inequality. But I've come up with two just to sort of highlight this trend. First is in terms of employment. One of the things we see in this slide is that unemployment in every region of the world but the Middle East and Northern Africa has actually increased in recent years. Okay, so unemployment is one element of insecurity. It's probably a poor measure, especially in developing countries, because people will find work even if there's no work to be found because they can't afford to be unemployed. All right. But I want to turn to another, perhaps better measure, and that is a measure which is an indicator of the informal sector in developing countries. In terms of this informal sector, one of the things we see in all the regions of the world, including Asia, we see an increase here in the non-agricultural self-employment in developing countries, right? So when I talk about the informal sector, I'm talking about people who are working as more casual laborers. They're ununionized. They oftentimes don't have contracts, so they have a insecure status. And we see in all regions of the world that informal sector growth has, in fact, increased quite substantially. In fact, in Africa, 90% of all new employment that was generated during the 1990s and early 2000, in fact, was in the informal economy. In Latin America, 80% of new jobs created were in the informal sector, right? So this is a rapidly growing sector, and it's another manifestation of economic insecurity. Okay. One other thing I want to say is that not only is there growing economic insecurity, but there's also growing physical insecurity. So that studies have shown, and we cite this in the report, that violent crime is associated with greater levels of inequality. And I must say, one of the most striking findings I found in working on this report was a World Bank survey of poor people called Voices of the Poor, which found that in the minds of the poor, physical insecurity has become a more serious problem than poverty. Right? So this is a survey of thousands of people in developing countries, and they all, a larger share said that physical security was a much more serious problem for them than poverty was. So it's a very striking finding, and I think we need to do more studies to better appreciate the whole idea of insecurity now in today's world. All right, so let me then conclude by focusing on the final question, that is, how do we overcome the persistent problem of inequality? Right, and here let me say that the task force doesn't come out with specific policy recommendations. I have some ideas myself, and I'm happy to discuss them. They're my own individual ideas, not those of the task force nor of the American Political Science Association. But we did come up with some general ideas based on the findings we had in reviewing studies about the relationship between inequality and development. All right. So the task force, in fact, cites studies finding that increasing the accountability of political leaders actually alleviates many of the problems of inequality and development. Right? We also cite studies that find that increasing popular participation in democratic political processes makes growth less volatile. It makes growth more equitable, so that the distributional outcomes are more equitable, and it also creates superior, that is, more efficient economic institutions. So there are studies that provide hard data to support those arguments. So the first point I have here is that improving the accountability of political leaders and increasing political participation are associated with less volatile growth, more equitable distribution, and superior economic institutions. Then the second sort of trend that we noticed in terms of overcoming the problem of persistent inequality in terms of economic development is encouraging the development of the institutions of capitalism and democracy, I think we all would agree, are important ways of helping to overcome the problems of inequality. But in fact, these are best encouraged in ways that reflect local history and culture. For it's when capitalism and democracy reflect the history and culture of societies that they are most likely to flourish. So insofar as people of the United States and other people in wealthy countries are involved in the process of development in poor countries, they should be aware and indeed better informed about their distinctive conditions. Playing a positive role requires listening to and engaging the social and political goals formulated by actors in poor societies, and then finding ways to assist people in these societies to implement their own solutions. So rather than promoting development through imposition, in fact, we should promote development through more interaction. Thank you.
John, I want to turn right to Gerard to get your comments, and then we'll open it to discussion.
Good morning. Can you hear me? You can hear me even without this. I'll start by warning you that I'm at a disadvantage here because, as a discussant, I'm pinch-hitting a little bit, as John suggested, and my research background is not in political economy, particularly the political economy of development. So in terms of familiarity with a lot of this research, I'm at a slight handicap, which, this being Washington, won't stop me from closer? Is this all right? Won't stop me from weighing in with an authoritative tone of voice. My first reaction is to thank John and the other members of the task force for a lot of work, both in the sense that the report covers a huge amount of ground and research. It required engaging with a by now enormous set of different literatures. And secondly, it represents a lot of work in that it advances analysis that goes well beyond conventional claims and predictable lines of argument, ones that we might have expected from a report on development and equality. It's innovative and it carries a lot of punch, and I'll be addressing that in time. This being hyperpartisan Washington, however, I'll follow my initial praise by paraphrasing Mary McCarthy and saying that I also want to and plan to disagree with every single word in the report, including and the, right? I exaggerate, of course. As I say, there's a great deal to recommend here, and I encourage you to spend some time with the report. But there are things that it's my task as the designated AEI respondent to take issue with, which I'm happy to do. The presumptuous thing to do would be to say that addressing these reactions could strengthen the report, but I do intend my comments to be in that spirit of constructive engagement rather than bashing or being dismissive, because it doesn't merit it, the report. My first set of comments, in fact, you'll notice, is not countering things the report says particularly or things that I believe that the task force members happen to believe, which I, in many cases, don't. Instead, I'm proposing that things be on our agenda that I think a report on inequality in the global economy needs to say in our intellectual climate, which the report doesn't always emphasize sufficiently, including, and this may sound more subversive than it really is, are we sure that inequality is as important as the report makes it out to be? Now, traditionally, concerns about inequality have been largely normative in nature. I think 30 or 40 years ago, a report on inequality in the developing countries would have treated inequality as a simply undesirable goal in itself and asked how to redress it. And I think that would have belied a set of zero-sum assumptions which were once prevalent that would be strikingly out of place at a time in history when positive-sum aspects of economies are on display perhaps more than ever before. But that traditional concern with inequality as an end in itself is not what this report really emphasizes. Instead, it's much subtler and in that sense moves our debate substantially forward because it argues that inequality can have very tangible consequences, in particular, that inequality matters because, and I quote, inequality enables powerful actors to shape political and economic institutions to reinforce their power at the expense of others and of the broader social welfare, unquote. In other words, steep inequality risks becoming self-perpetuating, including by limiting gains from growth, including by limiting growth itself. But I'm not fully persuaded that it's really this straightforward. Let me say, first, that the report is not predictable or simplistic when making this argument. it would have been easy for the report to hold rich countries, for example, responsible for the ills of less developed ones. The easy response to that by someone like me would have been to say that national-level issues, dysfunctional policies, leadership, et cetera, are more plausible culprits for problems in developing countries. This report actually addresses both sets of issues, both ones emerging from the international system, global trading rules and much else, and national-level ones. And this could sound like those two things are in tension, after all, and I think this would have been the case in a debate in a panel like this 20 years ago. Look, if you're acknowledging that national-level policies are a problem, then how can you possibly blame international or aspects of the international system? But the report is much more subtle than that. It is saying, I think, that the two are actually highly interactive, that aspects of the international system can and do reinforce distortions of national-level economies, and that that's the point, that this is a much more complex set of events. That said, let me give some simplistic responses nonetheless. First, on a purely normative level, I think it's worth pointing out, it's worth our reemphasizing, that just as inequality is hardly a goal that any of us have, so egalitarianism also cannot be our top goal. After all, India and especially China no doubt had higher lower Gini coefficients between, say, the 1950s and the 1980s or 90s than they do today. The same might well be true of the U.S., using whatever measures of inequality we want. But who among us would trade the contemporary versions for any of these economies for their predecessors of decades past? The fact is that inequality in each of these countries has grown somewhat at the same time that their aggregate economies have grown enormously. A vastly larger economic pie is almost always preferable to a smaller one, even if inequality grows as well. The poor have grown richer, even if they haven't grown richer as fast as the rich have grown richer. That may not be evident, however, to all readers of a report which notes with what I presume is concern that, quote, China has been transformed from one of Asia's most equal societies to one of its most unequal ones, unquote. At one very important level, my response to that was, so what? Who cares? Chinese have grown richer across the board. Who among them would vote to go back? The fact that societies, and this is really the point, can move independently across the aggregate economic and distributional economic dimensions means that we have to really, that's a set of facts that poses questions about what exactly the relationship is between inequality and growth. We'd hardly be the first person to entertain that discussion. The report at times seems to imply that inequality and growth are trade-offs. I'll get to that momentarily. But it also acknowledges that growth and inequality seem compatible, at least for long stretches in some cases. If we don't know enough about the relationship between the two, and we don't, then we should proceed with care, I think. Because the single most important thing I think we can do is not reduce the growth that has so effectively dented developing world poverty in recent years, real durable, absolute level poverty. Secondly, my response to the issue of inequality. The report offers hope that that concern I just stated, that we could somehow tamper with and undermine growth rates, really might not be an issue, that that shouldn't be a concern for a more egalitarian project, if you will. That, in fact, redressing inequality may actually enhance growth for the reasons that John just suggested, and that is because in conditions of severe inequality, elites can design institutions in ways favorable to them. If that were true, then the expectation should logically be, if elites really do monopolize, at least attempt to disproportionately seize gains from growth in situations of inequality, we should expect logically that patterns of wealth and poverty are highly path-dependent, self-reinforcing. At least patterns of steep inequality we should find to be highly path-dependent. But it's not so clear to me that that's really the case when we step back and look at the macro picture. Most famously, first of all, today's rich countries were much more inegalitarian at the heights of their industrial revolutions than they are now. If elites in today's rich countries tried to monopolize opportunities for gain, they didn't do a very good job of it, whether in absolute or relative gains terms. Second, and this is, I think, ultimately more important, it really is my fundamental point, effective elite monopolization of gains isn't clear in the interstate arena, in the international arena. It is may well be true that inequality between countries has grown. In fact, that's where the growth in global inequality has come from in recent decades. But the vast economic rise of the East Asian NICs and then China and then India, countries which, might I point out, jointly represent about 45% of the developing world's population, I think their vast economic expansion casts serious doubts on the proposition that international constraints are what have held back the poorest states and caused current levels of interstate or global inequality. That, to me, is a great fact looming over a number of the assumptions of the report, and it merits engaging with more in greater depth. to be specific about claims about global equality, inequality, and the effects of the international system. And then the conventional claim of dependency theory, after all, was that rich countries rig rules of trading in their favor, even more in their favor than you'd expect between commodity exporters on the one hand and manufactured goods exporters on the other. I would only point out as an aside that given the price of oil and other commodities today, this is a very awkward time in history to be alluding to that claim, as this report does, admittedly only to an extent. I think that the vast transfer of income, as another aside, a vast transfer of income that has occurred from developed countries to Middle East OPEC members alone every year since the mid-1970s is a very interesting element of the global economy that deserves more of a place in this discussion than it usually receives. The Middle East and other significant oil exporters have a, I think, somewhat pale presence in this report, and yet they are a very interesting category that I think raises interesting questions about just how much rich countries have been able to rig global trading rules to their advantage. The same might, and this has become a bit of a hobby horse of mine, the same could be said of remittances, which may well represent today over $200 billion a year and which are, if I may be snarky about it, a strange way for elites or elite countries to tax or monopolize gains. In fact, as the report candidly points out, they have, if anything, represented a factor mitigating global inequality, and in that sense, I think, deserve more than two sentences in a report of this extent. In other words, if I can sum up my last few thoughts, claims that elites, either elite categories of people within a given country or elite countries, design favorable institutions that then prove dysfunctional when considering aggregate, both distributional and aggregate growth issues, find the most plausible specific evidence of acts performed like that at the interstate level, say in the design of this or that global trading rule. But that level, the interstate level, also provides very mixed evidence of the expected outcome, the dependent variable, which would be a severely constrained ability of poorer states to become wealthier, given what China, India, and other countries have been doing for some time now. At the nation-state level, in contrast, the expected outcome of elite monopolization, which is severely constrained social mobility, is evident in many, many cases. But this report, and most others with which I'm familiar, does not identify nearly as specifically and persuasively the mechanisms by which elite monopolization might be causing that. I'm emphasizing all of this, of course, in the spirit of a free market-oriented perspective, which has long suggested that durable poverty can be more plausibly traced to national-level policies inhibiting entrepreneurship and economic dynamism. That perspective might also take pains, second snarky intervention, that perspective might also take pains to point out that some of the most spectacular cases in which we know of elites monopolizing gains from growth have occurred in highly statist systems isolated from the global economy, the past and current communist states most obviously. So if I'm emphasizing national-level factors as the primary obstacles to mitigation of interstate inequality, do international rules and other aspects of the international economic system feed those national level problems that I'm referring to? Here again, I think, and this is really my most important analytic point, I think, that East Asian NICs, China and India, loom over that issue. Why did they not get caught in the same nets of poverty perpetuation that other states did, the Burmas, the Chads, and others of this world, if the international system is the cause? Now, I don't want to be overly simplistic, but at the very least, I think, it suggests that international effects must be interacting with national-level factors in ways that are complex enough to have so far escaped our fine analytic grasp. In that spirit, that more market-oriented one, that focus on national-level characteristics, I will mischievously say that two of the report's most persuasive points are its implicit, not explicit, critique of rich country agricultural subsidies and condemnation, implicit condemnation of rich country tariffs on the importation of even minimally processed products, such as textiles and processed food products from developing countries, of which John just referred to cocoa versus chocolate, for example. I'll infer that such subsidies and tariffs ought to be eased or abolished, and I'll playfully say to the task force members that the neoliberal waters are warm on this issue and they should feel free to jump in. It's also possible, and this is a second, I think, line of critique that will carry me through to the issue of democracy and inequality. It's worth considering that some of the implicit recommendations here, the directions in which this report would point us, are in tension with one another. And I think the issue of possible trade-offs in a frustratingly imperfect and inconvenient world ought to be a second topic of concern. For example, and I'll just reel off a few, easing tariffs in rich countries on light manufactured goods such as textiles could conceivably exacerbate inequality in the developing countries that then have more opportunity to export those goods in countries like Pakistan, for example, as the most successful firms and families take disproportionate advantage of new export opportunities. There's no particular reason to think that could not happen. The report also, at some level, implicitly seems to lament the narrow targeting of foreign direct investment, how it's concentrated in certain developing countries instead of diffused more broadly. But the report also acknowledges that foreign direct investment can, under certain circumstances, polarize local wage structures, which implies that the more diffuse it is, the more you'd see, you might see inequality following it. The report seems implicitly applauds the easing of migration permission into rich countries, but brain drains have also been identified as reducing growth rates in some less developed countries, and so on, could exacerbate interstate inequality. So what they take, what these possible reforms take with one hand, they might give back with the other. And it's in that spirit that I want to draw attention to one of the report's most important discussions, to which I think a lot of your reading time and consideration should be given, which concerns the relationship between democracy and economics. The report identifies an apparent paradox that John just referred to between the simultaneous spread of democracy and the spread of inequality or its exacerbation in developing countries. In my own work, if you'll forgive me, I've acknowledged that there are dangers that severe social conflicts can endanger democratic stability. Now, conflict truly does not emanate straightforwardly from inequality, but there is a pattern nonetheless. For democratizers, severe inequality, material inequality, is what the FBI might call a person of interest, right? Something well worth keeping one's eye on, even if it's not an utterly straightforward and unambiguous culprit in causing democratic breakdown. The report, however, I think is most innovative in asking how causal influence can run in the other direction. Can democracy be harnessed for inducing greater equality or mitigating inequality? Above all, it suggests having that effect by making democracy, and I quote, more responsive to the needs of their underprivileged citizens, unquote. Most more inclusive elections, for example, and other things that I think John would happily refer to in a discussion session are examples of possible reforms in that direction. I think this should figure large in our discussion, so I'll just limit myself for the moment to saying a few things. But they generally have the tone also, maybe predictably, of our needing to be cautious in this regard. I'll be standing in a long line when I say that there may well be trade-offs, for example, between political egalitarianism and the growth on which so much of this report hinges. To illustrate rather than explain, I think there's a very decent chance that when Evo Morales retires, Bolivia might be more economically egalitarian than when he entered office. I also bet it'll be poorer than it could have been. The classic way to make this argument is that political egalitarianism often generates tax, spending, and regulatory policies that inhibit growth, redistributionist ones, if we want to call them that, but ones that free marketeers have insisted have negative sum effects. And I think that with amendments, that basic argumentative thrust has withstood the test of time just fine. But the real point is trade-offs. By suggesting that inequality can be bad for growth and also bad for democracy, the implication is that greater social equity, mitigated inequality at the very least, democracy and growth can run together, right? This is a very happy scenario. So happy that there's a risk that it's a recreation of what Guillermo O'Donnell and others have called the optimistic equation, which presumed in earlier periods of political science that democracy and growth were close companions. Here, the optimistic equation might be that with a more progressive flavor, adding a dose of egalitarianism to the mix, arguing, as I say, that greater equality, democracy, and growth can be mutually reinforcing. The first a priori reason to be skeptical of this is just the sad fact that God or Mother Nature or fate have so far been pretty cruel to all too many optimistic equations for us not to brace ourselves for this not to turn out quite that way. The more detailed reason is obviously that there are ways to trace the effects of more redistributionist policies and their effects on growth. The classic scenario from interwar Europe and early post-war Latin America would be that democracy is a hothouse, highly hospitable to highly redistributionist economic policies that result in momentary economic crises, which are the context hothouse is highly hospitable for military coups and democratic breakdowns. Without suggesting that that's how some of the more populist experiments, for example, in Latin America are going to go, I only want to suggest that there are reasons to think that this now triad that is supposed to might optimistically work together harmoniously may be that we may have a priori scholarly reasons, not just fatalistic ones, to suspect that it may not be that simple. That said, all of this said, I don't doubt for a moment that there are many ways in which responsiveness to the input of average citizens could aid or reinforce growth, growth that will diffuse socially with time. Most obviously, I echo the report's emphasis on education and health outcomes, although even here, perhaps compulsively, I feel the need to be more skeptical that government-provided education and health is the most efficient or effective route to those outcomes. That said, there's a lot of meat here, and I think if this is not the right wrong house in which to say this, that we should chew on that in our discussion for a little while.
Thank you. Your compulsions are very friendly, and I like that, and I like the spirit in which you both kind of laid this on the table and really sharpened the conceptual and analytic and empirical issues before us. That was a great job, both of you, so thank you. Let me open it to questions if anyone has. I mean, if you do have a question, please tell us who you are, if you don't mind.
I'm Helen Lefell. I'm the Resources for the Future, and I worked for 5 years in China. I worked in Indonesia and so forth, Central Asia. But I wonder if you could be a little more explicit with some particular illustrations of your claim that both democracy and capitalism are more likely to flourish if the peoples of developing areas can grow institutions and forms that reflect their histories and cultures. That's very general, and I really don't know exactly what the message is.
Okay, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it. Let me give you sort of a negative example, and then I can give you more positive examples. But before I do, let me say that this position, I think it's actually, this report really does try to move beyond ideological differences. So that there were some references Gerard made to sort of statist solutions. And this report is not an advocate of statist solutions. In fact, I would argue that one of the points of the report is actually that market-based solutions are affected by inequality and actually could bring even greater benefits if, in many cases, inequality were sort of less. So it's not, at one point in the report, we write that we need to move beyond sort of market and state distinctions, market versus the state. Anyway, to get to your point, I suppose the classic example of intervening in a country where we were insensitive to local culture and history, it's a very easy one, would be Iraq, where we went in, to my way of thinking, especially after the Bush administration rejected a State Department report of several thousand pages that went through the history and talked about some of the possible outcomes as a result of American intervention on the base of the culture and history. We clearly went into Iraq being ill-informed about the distinctive nature of the society, the different groups in society, et cetera. So this is one case of what I would call sort of intervention through imposition that proved to be, depending on your point of view, either disastrous or at least less effective than what it could have been had we been better informed about circumstances here. So once again, in terms of talking about transcending ideological differences, this is actually sort of a very conservative perspective that goes back to Edmund Burke in his classic reflections on the French Revolution, where he said, you have to be very careful about intervening without being sensitive to local circumstances, et cetera. Now, let me give you a more positive example, because negative examples are good. And positive example, I mean, one could refer to the particular evolutionary pattern of reform in a country like China, which really did sort of take into account local circumstances, local cultures, et cetera, in terms of different interventions. I actually think recent American foreign policy really hasn't been sufficiently sensitive to local cultures and histories in terms of its democracy promotion program, for instance. And I think also that this is an implicit critique in in here, I'll get a little partisan, I guess, in some of the more neoliberal, what I'll call sort of market fundamentalist approaches. That is that to argue that in the best example of this would be, say, Russia and Eastern Europe more generally, where the idea was that we have a plan, we want to simply expand the role of markets without taking into account things like the local networks, social networks that underpin markets, the local cultural history, et cetera. So in that sense, the point is not to say that markets shouldn't have been expanded in a country like Russia during the 1990s, but the point is to say that actually, in a way that's very conservative, we needed to be more careful in how we promoted the expansion of markets so that we could, in fact, take into account the local networks, the local culture, et cetera, that provided values that underpin the working of markets. And had we been more sensitive and perhaps less in a rush to follow sort of a more Big Bang approach, but a more perhaps cautious evolutionary approach, in fact, our policies to promote development and change towards a more market-based society in a country like Russia would have been more effective.
This is just sort of back there. Morning, Anderson. I'm a research analyst working on a book re-evaluating the sorts of things LIFELIKE started with the types of democracies. Don't know whether I can extend it to the developing ones, but principal findings, the principal dimensions I'm finding are inclusive, exclusionary, and how top-down order they control it. The word democracy is sort of a taken for granted in much of these kinds of discussions. And I think we need to pick it apart very much, because if democracy is taken as the formalism it usually now is taken as, that is, elections, it can serve to increase inequality just as much as equality. The typical examples are when what you're doing in an election is deciding which subgroup of society is going to dominate which other one. That is, in principle, completely neutral as to degree of inequality. However, there's another thing that goes along with it very often, which is increasing democracy is increasing centralization. And that will increase violence and increase conflicts and so on. So we need, I think, to work very much. This also is why democracy has not been as appealing recently in some areas. The solution, oddly, is one that that I have most focused on, but unfortunately can get virtually no data on because it's not done anywhere, is that internal to legislatures, it's the rule of the jungle. That is, citizens do not impose on their legislatures the requirement to distribute, to be inclusive, rather than the largest plurality to take total control and exclude others. And we know that has happened more in our society recently than it had in the past, and it can come from both sides of our political spectrum. So what I'm trying to point to, I think I said at the beginning, that is, democracy is not a primitive term we can use. So increase of democracy compared with increase of inequality is to me rather an unmeaningful category to be using in this kind of report. I think it needs to be more important categories are the ones that actually characterize countries, which are how inclusive are they? Do they treat all members of society as part of us rather than us versus them?
Well, I think that's a wonderful point, and it's actually consistent, I think, with the spirit of this report. We begin talking about this puzzle. I hate to talk in terms of paradoxes. It's one of the more overused words. But it's a starting point, right? Because I think it's true that most people generally expect the political equality that accompanies democracy, at least in formal terms. I mean, there's a real question of whether democracies actually promote substantial political equality, because, of course, there are different points of access and different rates of participation, et cetera. But to sort of set up the problem as a beginning point rather than sort of an ending point. But where I say that the spirit of the report is quite consistent with your observations is that we feel that you really do need to deconstruct democracy, that it's such a gross category. And I will say this, first of all, that as democracy has spread to more and more countries, the democratic experience has become even more diverse. And so, in fact, that makes it all the more necessary to sort of deconstruct and talk about different categories. One of the ways that we do this, before I say that, I should say that there is a lot of debate amongst the different members of our task force on this issue. And particularly, we had a very engaged and provocative debate about electoral institutions. All right, and there's a debate in the literature, and you know, we really couldn't resolve that debate, and so it really didn't make its way into the final version of our task force report. But that's just one example of one of the variables within this broad concept of democracy that could be a factor in affecting sort of the impact of democracy on economic development and on inequality that I'll raise. But as I was saying, as democracy expands to more and more countries, in fact, democratic experience becomes more variable. One of the things we do is we cite data, studies by Larry Diamond, for instance, which raise questions about the quality of democracy. So even though democracy in 205 was in 122 countries, the quality of democracy really varied quite substantially. And that's important because I think that's a factor in terms of the impact of democracy on inequality. If, in fact, you have very limited democracy, I mean, I would argue there's a tendency to sort of have that be more conducive to larger amounts of inequality, which is sort of consistent with our argument, which I suppose can be disputed. But what we did find, and this is, I think, a suggestive finding, is a number of studies, and these come from both political scientists and economists, that argue that to the extent to which actually things like property rights are equitably enforced, things like broader civil liberties are equitably enforced, political leaders are held more accountable, and participation was more inclusionary, we did find that that had a positive effect on economic development in terms of making outcomes more equitable, in terms of making growth more volatile, and in terms of, as economists more than political scientists are now want to do, have criteria to prescribe what are more desirable economic institutions and what are less desirable economic institutions. And let me just say one last thing here, for those that follow trends in development economics, institutions have become sort of the most important variable in terms of trying to predict whether countries are going to have good growth or whether they're going to have limited or bad growth. And within that field, there's a growing appreciation for the quality of institutions. And so there are very interesting studies that highlight democracy both acting to contribute to promoting better quality, more efficient institutions, precisely because democracy allows for input from the bottom up on the nature of the needs that these institutions need to fulfill, therefore those institutions end up promoting sort of more equitable and better growth.
Yeah, no, I don't want to preempt your interaction with John to discuss the report full frontally, but I would weigh in on a relationship between the two first questions. The status of democracy in these conversations is reflects its status in a lot of conversations now, just among democratization advocates, practitioners, skeptics, and so on, scholars. Them alone, even if they're not asking growth-related questions. And that is not so much exactly what is democracy, but which parts of it do we care about? How do we decompose it into these meaningful categories? And I think, you know, Fareed Zakaria did a great service when he put into our languages reference to a liberal democracy, if for no other reason that he was pointing out to us and really, you know, forcing a lot of people to internalize the fact that democracy reduced to this or that strand of itself can constitute a very pale imitation of what we typically mean by it in its more robust sense. That said, I think there's a very, I would say, real danger, because I don't know that it's a bad thing, but there is the possibility that a lot of democratizing language has been so put off by mere electoralism, that it's pushed it in what were what became after a time sort of the more cynical classical European liberal conceptions of a century ago or more, that the parts of democracy we ought to really care about the most are the liberal ones, if you will, the rights, the institutional barriers of the limitations of central power, and almost at the neglect of the popular ones. That if, in other words, I think there's a, what would be the reference here in terms of economic theory, there is an interesting, intriguing possibility that in many quarters we're moving towards a sort of Chicago Boys style, that if you could get either rights enforcement right or democracy, electoralism right, popular consultation, better the former and don't worry about the latter. And I think some East Asians are very prone to this. Their arguments are that, look, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, you know, get growth right first, get institutional constraints right, and don't worry about competitive elections. That will probably come in good time when it's a robustly middle class and wealthy society. Wait till it's per capita income is over $20,000 a year and then worry about it. And that's, look, if history proves that that's the right route, I suppose, you know, it's not a bad thing. But I think enough of history doesn't prove that. India front and central, that it is, we know it's more messy than that. We know it's more complicated than that. Not only ought we not to assume that the original that sort of adapted modernization version, get growth right, wealth right, and then democracy will follow, might not be true, but that it may well be that there are many other routes that would introduce popular input and more moral equity into societies far, far before that those wealth thresholds kick in. And I think it's a sort of a cautionary element put into that conversation there.
I want to interject one. It's a question, and we don't have to try to answer it, but it's a research question, and maybe there is an answer. And that it seems to me that there is kind of an experiment that either has been done or might be done analytically between China and India, because you've got rising rates of growth, you've got obviously different political systems and approaches, and you've got rising inequality within countries. And so as an experiment to look at how and whether and how inequality is addressed in those two giant states would be an interesting thing over time and may shed some light on this issue of democracy as a variable or not.
Could I just respond in a second? Because I think I want to address some of the issues that were raised in a sort of a general way. I am very grateful to Gerard in pointing out that this is not a simplistic report with sort of clear simplistic findings. I would be the first to admit that there are authoritarian states that have grown sort of quite well. There are democracies that, in fact, have been economic disasters, okay? The argument here, and I want to sort of address China in just a second here, the argument here in terms of the relationship between democracy and growth highlights a specific mechanism, and that is the, you might say, bottom-up input into the political process and therefore into economic policies and into the development and evolution of political institutions. One of the arguments here, just to give it a democratic example or an example of how inequality might produce disastrous economic development, would be a country like Haiti. Haiti, as was much of the Caribbean in, let's say, the 17th century, was actually much more fluent than the United States. I mean, people don't sort of really think about that, but the Caribbean being a central focus for sugar production, which was one of the most lucrative crops in the world at that time, actually had higher levels of economic development than the United States. Today, of course, we know it's a basket case. And one of the reasons for that was the type of inequality, both in terms of economic terms with sort of colonial planters and slaves brought in, but also in terms of political terms that was created, it very much affected the pattern of economic development and the resistance to incorporating institutions that might allow for things like more effective industrialization, the Industrial Revolution, et cetera. We can think of other examples of that, all right? But the point I want to make here is that, in fact, we can envision unequal democracies or unequal authoritarian regimes like say, Brazil in the 1960s, growing very rapidly. But we can identify this mechanism, which quite oftentimes creates impediments to effective rapid growth and more equitable growth, and that is the limits on bottom-up participation in the development of economic policy. Now, that brings me to China, which in a way is an anomaly and a difficult case for our approach. But to my way of thinking, actually, China is an exception that supports the rule. In the sense of why did China develop so quickly? I would argue that it has much less to do with the fact that China was an authoritarian system. In fact, China, to me, points out the example that we have to disaggregate the category of authoritarian systems to be much more sensitive to sort of local circumstances. I would argue, and I think that there's a strong consensus behind this point, that key to China's rapid growth beginning in 1978 until this date was the fact that its authoritarian leaders, through various means, were, one, more sensitive to local circumstances. In fact, China's economic reforms actually got started by a renegade experiment in Anhui province by a commune that decided, without any approval from above, that they were going to break up the communal control of land and let families operate their own farms. And that led to China's agricultural reforms, which led to the industrial reforms, and we see repeatedly that these reforms were particularly sensitive to local circumstances and therefore developed institutions that sort of maximized both the political imperatives, but also were very sensitive to the economic imperatives, but also were sensitive to the political constraints on the reform process. Okay, so China is an authoritarian system. In a sense, I say it provides support for our argument in that there was substantial bottom-up participation in the reforms despite the authoritarian system, and one of the consequences is that the reforms made the best use of local circumstances and recognized the constraints presented by those circumstances. We just feel that democracy is a political system that's more conducive to that type of inclusive participation in political policymaking and economic policymaking than authoritarian regimes. So on the whole, we'd see China as an exception to the authoritarian regime that in a way provides support for our arguments about variations, and there are substantial variations within democracy, and it's those variations we're trying to point out and highlight.
I'm going to give two people here who haven't had a chance, and then we'll end back with the second chancer.
Jeff Gertz, the Carnegie Endowment. Following on the last two questions, I wanted to ask you if the report sort of explicitly considers the difference between inequality of outcomes and inequality of opportunity. It seems that, you know, when you're showing income, that there's pretty good evidence that outcomes, inequality is increased. Again, education and health, you were saying it might be that the inequality is decreasing. So inequality of opportunities aren't decreasing, but inequality of outcomes is increasing. There's sort of an interesting story there, you know, maybe competing global markets is going to increase inequality of outcomes, even if inequality of opportunity is the same. You know, is that something we want to live with? Certainly changes how we're thinking about it from justice.
Right. Okay, let me say this, that we don't make an argument for equality of outcomes. Okay, and in fact, you know, I hadn't thought about it in these terms, but actually I think our argument is that inequality in opportunities affects the inequality in outcomes. Okay, so let me just give you one example to highlight what I mean. We are very concerned, I mean, following a tradition of, let's say, unequal enforcement of property rights. Right. So if some people can access and have access in the protection of property rights and other people don't, we argue that that actually is a defect in the institution of property rights that affects and limits the inclusiveness of the benefits of development. So that's why I say sort of inequality of opportunity, property rights is really an opportunity. So that's really what we emphasize in that sense. The idea of inequality of outcomes gets back to the issue of whether you think equality in and of itself is desirable. And the report really tables that issue. It doesn't sort of make that normative argument. Many people have made that normative argument, but that's not what we take on in the report.
I just wanted to ask, my name is Susan Zimmerman from the Treasury Department, International Affairs. I wanted to ask, what are the reasons why you said at the beginning of the presentation that you had some specific ideas about how to address inequality, and we would get into that. that later, and I just wonder if you would amplify on what
yeah, but I'm so glad you asked that question. But I want to, and I think it's really important that I preface that by saying that these are ideas that I've developed in a sort of separate work outside of the task force, related and inspired by the task force. One of the things that we're doing with this report, or the people that worked on this report, we had a conference, people wrote papers, we're going to come out with a book. So if I can sort of do an ad for that book, please allow me. But let me just briefly talk about some of the ideas that I have that sort of stem from this. And they really stem from two sort of issues. One is greater sensitivity to distinctive local circumstances. The other is sort of trying to promote the development of ideas and institutions from the bottom up. Okay? And so, one argument we make is that especially in terms of international negotiations for finance, but especially for trade, the WTO, there's need for more technical assistance to the poorest of the poor countries. There are some provisions for that, but I think they've been very stingy. And to give them proper voice, they need assistance, and that's one area that can be benefited. Another is what I call sort of the need for an International Development Evaluation Agency, whose acronym is IDEA or IDEA. I sort of like that. This is based on the idea that international multilateral programs like the World Bank and the IMF, the only real evaluation, rigorous evaluation of their programs that takes place is by the agencies themselves. It's sort of like the fox guarding the chicken coop. And so we feel that there should be an international agency that would be independent of them that should evaluate these programs. There's a debate here in the United States, as you know, about whether the IMF should continue, et cetera. This could help in that sense. From my perspective also, one of the advantages of this is that there's been a lot of pressure and some reforms in the governance of the IMF and the World Bank to make them more reflective of poorer countries. But those changes have been very limited and, to my sense, too limited. If we had this independent evaluative agency, one of the things we could do is we could create a governance structure that would make that agency also more accountable to poor countries. So that's a second idea at the international level. I'm very grateful to Gerard for highlighting the sort of interactive nature of sort of the international dimensions that we highlight in terms of inequality and the domestic dimensions in poor countries. So I want to talk just a quick discussion of some sort of ideas for programs that would deal with development within poor countries. And one idea we have is, or I've been developing, is an international fund for inclusive elections. Right, and this would, at the minimum, be a international organization, multilateral, that could draw on the experience of developed countries in terms of laws regarding public finance for elections. Because one of the things we've seen is with the change in mobilization strategies, we've seen that the need for campaign finance, et cetera, in fact, arguably could make the democratic process less inclusive than what it could be otherwise. And so we think that at a minimum, developing countries should consider and draw upon the experience of developed countries, most of whom have some sort of provisions for public finance, to consider public finance. That's the minimal approach. A more sort of ambitious approach would actually be to have developed countries contribute to a fund that could be made available to help finance public financing of elections in developed countries. This would be a multilateral fund, so it would be removed from the type of political considerations it might have and coupled with the expertise that it might have. So that's sort of one proposal. That, once again, I want to highlight is sort of coming from myself as an individual rather than the task force or the APSA. Another is a social entrepreneurial promotion program. And this would be, I envision this as, say, for instance, using the web to, in fact, have development agencies be transformed rather than have them get involved in service delivery, to have them outline problems and then to entertain, if you will, bids from social entrepreneurs within developing countries themselves. So let's say you feel in Africa HIV/AIDS is a problem, and it's a problem that you as an American development expert sort of wants to help to alleviate. You lay that out as a problem and entertain bids that could be submitted over the web. You could have a sort of pro forma format for the bids, et cetera, so you can compare them. And encourage these bottom-up solutions to the problems, all right? So that's a second one. And then the third idea I have is a development voucher program. That is oftentimes, I think now there's a growing consensus that decentralization is good. But oftentimes if you look at the politics in developing countries, you find that governments in developing countries are reluctant to decentralize finance to local levels. And here I'm not talking, I guess to some extent I might be talking about provincial governments, but I'm talking about even below provincial governments to local governments. They oftentimes really lack funding. And so one idea would be to give them vouchers, which they could use to choose between the services either of more central government agencies who have more expertise than the local governments do, because oftentimes one of the biggest impediments to localized development is the local governments don't have the expertise to solve their problems, or to use those vouchers to purchase services from NGOs who might have expertise for their problems. But the idea is it gives the local government, because they're local and therefore more responsive to localized needs, it gives them the flexibility and latitude to try to pursue those localized needs, but it marries those efforts with the expertise of agencies at the higher level of government or within the private sector. And we think that this would be have a good sort of immediate impact on development, but it also, I think, would have a very healthy impact as institutions evolved over time, because it would, I think, allow for a more efficient and effective, if you will, division of labor between the public sector and the private sector, and also division of labor within the public sector as well.
If, with your permission, maybe you could continue afterwards, but I'd like to give Gerard a chance if you wanted to comment, and then wrap it up, and then if you want to continue a little bit afterwards, that would be fine.
Well, just a quick comment on
we'll go ahead.
Inequality is a goal. So, to that.
Briefly.
There are now four or five books. I can only remember one of them at the moment, called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. But there are four or five of them now by physicians who have more and more been discovering that the chief cause of health problems is status inequality. It's the lack of control of one's life and the lack of predictability, so it may connect back to what you emphasized on physical insecurity, but the crucial thing is status inequality, the lack of control over one's life, the ability of someone else to dominate, suddenly jerk the rug out, change the conditions, etc. So that inequality is not just a matter of another goal. It has real physical consequences that are not factored out by rising wealth, however measured.
Thank you. Great. George, you want anything on that?
Just very briefly, from what I've read, that research is in fact much messier than you're making it sound. Much messier than you're making it sound. You're making it sound like there's a fairly unambiguous finding. That's not my reading of that that research. For example, the research, the research on, for example, on health disparities by race in the United States. A whole subset of that is about sort of, you know, anxiety induced by racism and so on. And that's, I've been at workshops where that was discussed, and it seems that the findings are really quite messy and difficult to interpret. To show more generally how much room for common ground there is on these things, and how this report is not a predictable, you know, emanation of a perspective, and instead a fairly subtle and complex thing with a lot of applicability. John and I have talked in the past, all the way back to yesterday, about a slew of the reforms, not just the list he just gave of possible concepts that might derive from this, but a longer list than just that. And I felt comfortable with a lot of them. I suppose I, if, I should say, with all but one of them, and I'll decide which one is later. I mean, it's just I've got to reserve some caution, right? To continue the playful streak, if John wants, I can try to put the task force in contact with Senator McCain's office, since they are the only current champions of public financing of campaigns in the United States.
I have no problem with
that.
Just sitting out there.
Could I just make a general... Since Gerard has brought about electoral campaigns, I will cast him as a pessimist and me as an optimist, right? in the sense, I think Gerard's position is that pessimism is just sort of realistic optimism. My position is that optimism is sort of realization of the limits of pessimism. What I mean by that is that, Gerard has, I think, and I take his point very seriously, sort of given a cautionary note about trying to mess with growth and development. And it's true, at least until sort of the recent oil price rise, which is going to have devastating consequences on some developing country economies, things, especially since 2003, have been gone very well. Actually, they didn't go nearly so well from 1980 to 2003, but that's indisputable, and we try to sort of recognize that. Why mess with that? Gerard's right to be prudent. On the other hand, he's also right to point to a long tradition in political science that says that all good things don't go together. And that's a tradition that sort of highlights the problems that democracy creates for economic development. I wish that our report were one where we had rigorous, indisputable, categorical findings. But to be perfectly honest, it's not. It's, I think, an effort to be a much more sort of nuanced report that, once again, highlights the importance of local circumstances, and in so doing suggests that we need to be careful and cautious about making broad generalizations. So I'm sort of very uncomfortable talking about democracy versus authoritarianism. Once again, I say it's really important to sort of deconstruct democracy, and we try to take an initial step in doing that in highlighting the participatory sort of importance of responsiveness as a dimension of democracy that varies from country to country, from democratic system to democratic system. We think that that's very important in highlighting the impact of development. Just one other thing, that is that Gerard is also pessimistic in the sense of basically taking the position that let's leave markets alone. Let's not mess with markets. And the report is, I think, has a fundamental difference with that position. The difference stems from the realization that I think political scientists should take more claim for, especially at the international dimension. That is that political scientists have, in talking about globalization and the development of international economic institutions, are highly aware of the fact that globalization, to the extent to which we can understand it as the internationalization of markets, is an ongoing process which is constructed and reconstructed over time. And one of the key drivers of the contingent outcomes of that process are power and politics between different countries. Right? And so our position, I mean, Gerard's position is let's let well enough be alone. Our position, in a way, is we can do better. And why not do better by taking into account the impact that inequality has and figuring out measures that might help to alleviate some of the problems that high levels of inequality, not all inequality, because we're not taking a position that we should have absolute equality, but that extraordinary high levels of inequality under some circumstances can cause. And that's our position, and that's why we are optimists and Gerard is a pessimist.
But a cheerful pessimist.
Yes.
I want to thank all of you for coming. I especially want to thank Katie Donaldson for also working with the association and setting up and doing all the work that made this event possible. Thank all of you for coming. Thank John and Gerard. And read the report and pass it on to friends, especially in other countries, as Eduardo suggested. Thank you again. Thanks.